At about 9 a.m. today, approximately 75 agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Environmental Protection Agency's Office of Criminal Investigations, assisted by representatives of the Department of Energy's Inspector General, began the execution of a federal criminal search warrant at the United States Department of Energy's Rocky Flats Nuclear Weapons Plant near Denver, Colorado.
Welcome to Return to the Nuclear Crossroads, a history of protest at our local nuclear weapons plant, Rocky Flats. In part four today, we listen to the 90s during the final push to close Rocky Flats. Activists then face the radioactive legacy created during 40 years of plutonium trigger production. I'm your host, David Wilson. In June 1989, the FBI raided Rocky Flats in search of environmental crimes. Anti-nuclear activists were stunned that one branch of the federal government would finally investigate another branch of itself. Following the raid, longtime peace activists like Leroy Moore, one of the founders of the Rocky Mountain Peace Center, saw an opening to end nuclear weapons production at Rocky Flats.
Well, that was outrageous. Right after that happened, about half a dozen activists, myself among them, went to see Governor Roy Romer. And we asked him to take steps by the 4th of July. We knew that he did not have the legal authority to stop anything at Rocky Flats. But we reminded him that he had incredible moral authority. And we called on him to use his moral authority to call for a halt to production at Rocky Flats until the facility could be shown to be safe.
At the same time, Greenpeace USA hired Jason Salzman to work full-time on shutting down Rocky Flats.
When the FBI raided it, that just opened the doors to all kinds of scrutiny, and the buildings were old. We had that on our side. It was just a matter of time. We kept digging in, and eventually the truth came out that those buildings were not adequate. It wasn't worth it.
But it would take a while for the problems at Rocky Flats to be fully revealed. Colorado Governor Roy Romer remained equivocal about closing the plant. He did, however, set a limit on how much plutonium waste Rocky Flats could store on site. Leroy Moore.
And I decided at that point to engage in a public fast of sorrow and solidarity, water-only fast focused on victims of Rocky Flats. And I was thinking of workers, I was thinking of people that might be the victims of explosion of one of these bombs somewhere someday. I was thinking of the people that were exposed to radioactive materials and other toxins around the plant.
Leroy Moore continued the fast until July 29th. Many people joined him during the fast for short periods. Now the Japanese Buddhist monk Sawada took Leroy Moore's place in the fast up until August 9th, the 45th anniversary of the atomic bombing of Nagasaki. 3 days earlier, on August 6th, Colorado Freeze Voter had organized another attempt to encircle the plant, with over 5,000 people showing up. Things were changing on a daily basis with Rocky Flats. Anti-nuclear activists scrambled to keep up. And while Colorado's governor wouldn't take a stand to close Rocky Flats, Idaho's governor did, indirectly. In September, Cecil Andrus closed Idaho's borders to Rocky Flats plutonium waste, ending 35 years of shipments to the Idaho National Engineering Lab. Rocky Flats would face a crisis. Building bombs created radioactive waste with no place to go.
Right around Thanksgiving, November of that year, 1989, Admiral Watkins, who was then Secretary of Energy, halted production at Rocky Flats. Temporarily, he said. The facility was so in such bad shape, badly contaminated, buildings were very dangerous to operate.
They hide the facts, the reason for PRMP is to build more bombs for you and me on Rocky Flats. You know we gotta find a way to shut that place down now. Let's not allow government to ruin the environment at Rocky Flats.
As soon as Rocky Flats suspended operations, the Department of Energy began talking about when they would restart the plant. In the process, they proposed the Plutonium Recovery Modification Project. Jason Salzman.
Was this effort to basically rebuild the plant in Denver, and that's what they would have loved to have done. You know, just start from scratch, build a new trigger manufacturing facility, and not have to hassle with moving it or deciding what else to do. And that was very unpopular because, and I think this indicates how, you know, how important the early activism was and how it dovetailed with what we did. You know, Skaggs and Wirth and others had really always been, they'd always taken the position that it's okay for now or earlier, you know, it's okay here, but no, once these buildings are old, you know, we can't rebuild it, we can't continue this in a metropolitan area. And so Skaggs and Wirth and every, you know, every credible politician anywhere in this region stood up and said, no way, we can't rebuild Rocky Flats. And that's how we pitched it that way. They didn't like that characterization of it. They preferred it as, well, we need this facility to eat up Rocky Flats itself, to chew up the buildings and stuff as they dismantled it and moved it. But that was total, you know, bunk, because it was obvious too, because they were investing a $500 million or more in a brand new facility that had all the it was in the weapons production budget, it had all the bells and whistles of a new trigger manufacturing facility, and it was obvious. And so they were in a real disadvantage arguing that. While some of the other restart issue and some of the other issues had some support from our own delegation and politicians.
More and more information came out during 1990 and 91 revealing the reasons for the original shutdown. The aging buildings were falling apart, and the Rocky Flats ventilation systems turned out to be full of plutonium. Activists like Leroy Moore worried this plutonium could reach a critical mass and explode into the environment.
They didn't want to have, I think, a major disaster of some sort. So they halted production. They then proceeded to spend $1 billion a year for the next 2 years trying to get back into production. And you will remember that every few weeks they would announce that Rocky Flats is going to resume production on so-and-so date.
Carolyn Beninsky of the Rocky Mountain Peace Center.
We're going to start off, and I'm going to just say a few words about where we are in terms of Rocky Flats. A year ago in December, Rocky Flats was shut down because they were doing such an incompetent job and there were so many violations that the government itself decided it better shut down the plant. Violations out there. But in terms of making bombs, they haven't made one bomb out there in 13 months.
Yay.
Pretty good, don't you think? And part of that is also because people like you have been protesting against the plant for, some of you for a year, some of you for 5 years, some of you for 20 years. How many people have been
about 16 tons and one in debt. A radioactive and we're deeper in debt. St. Peter won't be smiling when we reach the gates if we sell ourselves to nuclear waste. Well, they try to sell us fancy technological schemes. PRMP and uranium dreams. Well, think about it now. Who will pay the bill? If the strontium won't get you that plutonium.
Jason Salzman of Greenpeace.
It's true that this year has been a real good year for us at Rocky Flats. Plant's still closed. They haven't produced one nuclear trigger. But next year, we may not be as fortunate. And the reason is because David Skaggs and Governor Romer seem to continue to want the Rocky Flats horror show to continue. They won't call for the permanent closure of Rocky Flats. At Greenpeace, we wonder what it's going to take to convince Romer and Skaggs to stand up and demand that the plant be closed permanently.
Well, at one point, we thought the governor was supporting the restart too closely, so we took a bed to the state capitol, an actual bed, and we dressed up a Greenpeace activist as the governor and a Greenpeace activist as Rocky Flats, and we put the governor and Rocky Flats in bed together on the capitol steps. And so that was a strong message to the governor.
In late 1990, if you drove down Highway 93 past Rocky Flats, it was impossible not to notice the nuclear weapons plant due to the efforts of local artist Craig Freeman and Greenpeace's Jason Salzman.
We had 12 billboards in front of the plant. What happened was Craig and Greenpeace were both eyeing these empty billboards right in front of the Rocky Flats plant, you know, right there at the gate. And they were empty because citizens had demanded that they be so, and there was a campaign against those billboards, and that's why they were that way. We contacted the owner, and he said that he would donate them to our anti-Rocky Flats cause. I think his hope down the line was that he would profit from that somehow. So Craig put anti-nuclear messages on these 12 billboards, and in neon colors, and it was a great attractant there on Highway 93. The interesting part of it, and what generated the national press coverage, was when the group that originally opposed those billboards got very pissed off at Greenpeace and Craig for using them, and they staged a protest at our press conference unveiling them, in which Tom Lustig, a great activist in the Boulder area, stood up and disrupted my speech as we were unveiling those billboards. He called them litter on a stick. And they had approached us and asked us not to do it, and we thought that given their proximity to Rocky Flats and given the issues that it raised, you know, the invisible plutonium versus the visible blight of a billboard and the scenic environmental issues involved, we thought it was worth it to go ahead with it. But they had legitimate concerns, and we felt bad. But as it turned out, everybody won, because those billboards were actually removed from that area, and they're not there anymore.
In 1991, the war in the Gulf broke out.
No blood for oil. War. What is it good for? Nothing. Absolutely nothing. Nothing from nothing leaves nothing. You gotta have something. You gotta have peace.
And I was simply amazed. Everybody I knew was focused on stopping the war.
Tom Marshall.
And yet, at the same time, the machine kept grinding on. They wanted to keep on producing nuclear weapons. It was still happening as though this war wasn't going on at all. And I was rather amazed that there was somebody who was paying attention to all of this. And that happened to be some people at the Rocky Mountain Peace Center, as it was known at that time, and in particular, Leroy Moore. And I made a decision then that as soon as I could, I wanted to get more involved in the Rocky Flats issue, and that's what brought me into it.
I feel like I've been coming out here since...
Ellen Claver.
By 1977, and I know there's some other people who've been coming out here since even before that. And in some ways, it feels like maybe we're closer than ever to actually getting this place closed down. I can't believe it, but it does seem that way. There's still a lot of work to be done, though, and I really want to thank all the people that have continued to work over the years. I feel like I'm one of the people that sort of stepped back and let some other people take over, and I try and do what I can, just like I know all of you can, but I really want to thank all of those people that have really picked up, and all of us, I think, need to really... It feels like we're in the home stretch of this, you know, because it feels like it's really close, but we all have to really do our part, so... There's a woman in Japan, folding paper with her hands, singing songs of peace, teaching the young, teaching the old, teaching the world how to fold paper cranes of peace, flying now. Beauty before, beauty behind, beauty above and beauty below. Beauty all around.
The Soviet Union had collapsed by now and the Cold War was over. Yet through 1991, the Department of Energy continued to try to restart Rocky Flats. Leroy Moore.
Well, it never happened. They did not get back online. And it was January 1992 when George Bush, who was then president, gave the State of the Union address and announced in his State of the Union address that the W-88 warhead, which was the last warhead being made at Rocky Flats, it was the only mission they had at that moment, that the W-88 warhead production was being halted and canceled. When he announced that, people that like ourselves that were watching it from the outside and workers that were watching it from the inside, when we heard George Bush say that in his State of the Union message, it was clear immediately from those sort of code words almost that was the end for Rocky Flats.
And several days later, Admiral Watkins, head of the Department of Energy, made it official. Rocky Flats' mission would change. It would now become a cleanup site. Jason Salzman.
We were lucky here in this area, in Denver, this diversified economy, where we could get our politicians to even, you know, broach the issue of shutting down this plant or, you know, questioning the safety and all that. Most nuclear weapons production facilities in this country were built in rural areas where they were, the politicians from that area were totally trapped. They had no choice but to support the jobs and therefore the bomb production. Rocky Flats was different in the middle of the metropolitan area, which was growing, you know, and more yuppies and others were coming that had total distaste for that activity. And so the diversified economy really helped us.
Shortly after I began in a paid capacity here at the Peace and Justice Center, production did stop. So I tend to take credit for all of that.
Tom Marshall.
But there was really a debate at that time as to whether or not the Peace and Justice Center should continue working on the Rocky Flats issue. Production was stopped. We were a peace center. That's what we were known as at the time, the Rocky Mountain Peace Center. Should we continue working on the Rocky Flats issue? And we decided as an organization that, yes, there were still a number of issues that were very important at Rocky Flats, the legacy of nuclear weapons production that we had always said were important as the production, the health and safety issues, the environmental contamination, the waste issues, what we do with all of that plutonium that's out there. So we made a conscious decision at that time to continue our work on Rocky Flats.
I think a lot of people thought that the job was done.
Sam Cole, originally a volunteer at the Rocky Mountain Peace Center and KGNU, now directed the Colorado chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility.
For instance, our membership at Physicians for Social Responsibility really dropped after the end of the Cold War and the shutdown of Rocky Flats, and you saw the community kind of losing interest in the nuclear weapons, nuclear proliferation issue, because it became a lot more less obvious with the issues that we started to work on, namely the cleanup of Rocky Flats, what to do with the plutonium out there. Was Rocky Flats production going to happen elsewhere? There were some very important issues, but they were, I think, maybe more difficult to get across.
In 1992, a new type of Rocky Flats activist was born, the grand juror. Following the FBI raid in 1989, a grand jury was impaneled to review the evidence of environmental crimes at the plant. Wes McKinley, a self-proclaimed cowboy from southeast Colorado, was their foreman.
I would like to tell you what I know, but it's kind of like listen to a joke. Is it funny? You never know till after you hear it. And that's kind of the situation I'm in. I don't know whether I have to say it's worthwhile for you to hear or not. I'd kind of like to tell you. And then you have to make up your own mind. So what did the Rocky Flats grand jury do?
After 2.5 years hearing testimony and reviewing documents about Rocky Flats activities, the grand jury sought indictments of 8 former or present employees for environmental crimes at the weapons plant. However, a deal was cut between the Department of Justice and Rockwell International, who had operated the plant until they quit following the FBI raid. In the deal, an $18 million fine was imposed on Rockwell for violating environmental laws, but no individuals were prosecuted. Sam Cole of Physicians for Social Responsibility.
What was really amazing about the Rocky Flats grand jury was throughout the history of Rocky Flats, there was enormous secrecy. And the public wanted to know more, and we couldn't get information, although we had our suspicions about what was going on out there. Then, with the convening of the grand jury, you had a group of average people, average Colorado citizens, having access to all these documents that we always dreamed about having access to, and were outraged about what they found out, about the dangers around Rocky Flats and what had taken place at Rocky Flats and the environmental crimes that had taken place out at Rocky Flats. And they really verified our deepest, darkest suspicions about just how bad things really were out there. And they recommended some very, very stiff penalties to be taken and swift action to be taken, yet that was ignored.
Along with being ignored, the grand jury was bound to secrecy. Jury Foreman Wes McKinley.
Because if we had gone out and verified or said anything here, we're criminal contempt of court. And what would you have felt like when you were on the grand jury? If you were on the next, or you were called, because this is just the people. We had to have public attention, so I said, well, I'll go out on the courthouse steps and read a letter to then President Clinton. He had been elected in 92, there in the November election.
President-elect William Clinton. Please direct the district attorney to appoint a special federal prosecutor.
And Al Gore was quoted in the paper as saying the grand jury report should be released. So we wanted this information out. David Skaggs had said the grand jury should be allowed to carry out their duty. And Patty Schroeder was saying, you know, where there's lots of smoke, there should be some fire. Let's do it. So I had lots of support. So I wrote President Clinton a letter, and then I went out on the courthouse steps and read it out loud. The Justice Department, the FBI, was there in attendance and had the warrants sworn out for my arrest because it had been let up. We'd sent some media packets out, and they thought the grand jury was going to go out and tell all. And, of course, had I done that, I would have been thrown in jail, and it would have been sensational news. And every reporter has given me their home number. Please call me when the FBI comes after you. We want to know. But so far, we have survived because we really come close, they said, but haven't been charged.
Tom Marshall of the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center.
By a deal being cut, the effect of that was that the grand jury report was sealed. Not only was the grand jury report itself sealed, but we were not able to hear the testimony that the grand jury heard. The public of Colorado was denied that. And I think we would have learned quite a bit had that process gone forward.
While the Rocky Flats grand jury gave up on pursuing specific individuals for their crimes at Rocky Flats, they still hope to have their findings fully revealed and are in court today trying to remove their gag order. In the years following the end of Rocky Flats' mission as a nuclear weapons producer, the nature of protest and anti-nuclear activism has taken on new forms. Tom Marshall.
As I said, I came in at the time that Rocky Flats shut down. So I sort of picked up, as I see it, where a number of people left off. And for me, it was quite easy to make the connection between the need for disarmament work and the need for the environmental part of the solution at Rocky Flats. And my feeling is that it's our responsibility here at the Peace and Justice Center to make sure that the problems that still exist are addressed responsibly. The way we work on the issue, I think, has changed quite a bit from the way the issue was worked on in the late 70s and early 80s, and even the late 80s. Well, I think that we've been able to institutionalize some of the gains that people working during those earlier periods were able to make. So in other words, we have right now a Citizens Advisory Board, and the Peace and Justice Center worked hard along with a number of citizens organizations across the country to establish Citizens Advisory Boards around these sites, and these boards are funded by the Department of Energy, but at least in the case of Rocky Flats, it's quite an autonomous body. It has a budget, we're able to hire staff, and we're able to get information and give input on the decisions that are happening out there. I think we've made significant gains in gaining access to information. We have more information about what happens at the site and what happens in the nuclear weapons complex than we've ever had in the past. We've also gotten the idea across that the Department of Energy and the federal government and the regulatory agencies should be listening to the public and finding out what the public wants to have happen at these sites. What we have not been able to achieve is to actually get those agencies to listen to the public at this point.
So it's a gross example of non-democracy.
Leroy Moore.
One of the things that fascinates me about it is that not only is it probably more difficult than doing civil disobedience outside the gate, but it's also, there's so many hundreds of ways in which the voice of the activist is muted and compromised and deflected. Because suppose you're on the Citizens Advisory Board, as I was for 3 years. I was one of the people that pressed hard to get those kinds of advisory boards created at facilities like Rocky Flats, and we got the one that Rocky Flats created, and I served on it. But to deliberate something in that body means that you've got to deliberate it with the local government people, business interests, union workers from Rocky Flats, maybe the Chamber of Commerce interests, the people that want to develop land on or near the site, and so on, all of those different kinds of interests. And I will grant that all of them are legitimate interests, but I will say that they would not have a table to sit at if it were not for the Rocky Flats activists. They would not be talking about the Rocky Flats issue at all if it were not for the Rocky Flats activists for all of those years. So we created the situation, but we still, in some respects, have created a situation in which it's still possible to marginalize us.
Tom Marshall.
What does not occur is a situation where the Citizens Advisory Board or other entities issue a recommendation and the government says, yes, you're right, we see the wisdom in that, and we're going to implement that. It's a long, slow process, but we do have an effect, and it's more incremental than many of us would like to see happen. One instance has to do with waste disposal at Rocky Flats. The Department of Energy and the regulatory agencies were talking about creating a low-level waste dump at Rocky Flats. The Citizens Advisory Board and most organizations and many, many individuals in this area said, no, we don't want you doing that. It took a year's worth of work for them to agree to the fact that, no, they would not create a low-level waste dump at Rocky Flats.
While change is slow at Rocky Flats, one major difference between the 1990s and earlier activism relates to how workers and activists see each other. Again, Tom Marshall.
One of the benefits of the Citizens Advisory Board is that it brings together people of different interests, including workers and activists. And by spending time talking with one another in that sort of a forum, you are able to form alliances that you never will simply by going to hearings. And the same people that I used to be on the opposite side of the room from at large public hearings, I now sit with at a table. And we find that we have an awful lot in common.
Another major issue facing anti-nuclear activists in the 90s is Rocky Flats cleanup. The Department of Energy hopes to decontaminate and decommission the nuclear weapons plant over the next decade with a price tag of tens of billions of dollars. Sam Cole of Physicians for Social Responsibility.
How clean is clean at Rocky Flats?
Longtime Rocky Flats activist Chet Chizeski returned to Colorado in the 90s after working for several years at Greenpeace USA in San Francisco. He became part of the Rocky Flats Future Site Use Group that recommended cleaning up Rocky Flats to a natural state comparable to what it was like before the plant was built.
Rocky Flats, and I served for almost 2 years on a DOE-funded committee called the Future Site Use Working Group. Which was responsible for building community consensus on what should happen with the Rocky Flats site in the next generation of activities there. I have to say it was an interesting experience. I don't know whether I feel it was worthwhile. I'm afraid that our success at trying to democratize our government is only marginal because it goes through the motions and involves citizens in participatory ways and then ignores their preferences, even though this group, this Future Site Use Working Group, for example, managed to agree, some 30 people, including representatives of chambers of commerce, homeowners, workers, and activist groups, managed to get unanimous, or consensus anyway, on cleaning up, that we recommended to the federal government that they clean up the Rocky Flats site to background levels. Well, they've just ignored that and other recommendations that were consensus recommendations of a group that they said was to guide them. And so until the federal government and other government agencies can get clear about what they're empowering their advisory groups to do, I think it's a distraction for activists to get involved that way. There are plenty of other people who can do that work. And activists should maintain the advocacy role and not get sucked into bureaucratic roles which produce marginal results.
The Future Site Use Working Group that Chet Chizesky worked on also made recommendations about what to do at the Rocky Flats site once it is cleaned up. The group suggested that the land surrounding Rocky Flats be left as open space. What to do with the land where the buildings reside is more up in the air. Everything from leveling all the buildings and creating more open space to redeveloping the site with other industries were suggested. As cleanup progresses, the future of the Rocky Flats site itself will become more clear. But many other issues still remain at Rocky Flats. The Department of Energy plans on shipping off-site all of Rocky Flats plutonium, whether as waste or as trigger material to other facilities within the nuclear weapons complex. Some activists oppose contaminating and endangering other parts of the country in an effort to get rid of Rocky Flats problems. At the same time, the U.S. government continues to develop plans for a 21st century nuclear weapons complex. Los Alamos National Laboratory, the birthplace of the atomic bomb, now appears it will become Rocky Flats, too. You've been listening to part 4 of Return to the Nuclear Crossroads, a history of protest at Rocky Flats. This program will continue as part of KGNU's Nuclear Issues program called Going Critical. Airing the first Thursday of July and August at 8:35 a.m., Going Critical will explore the impact, both personally and politically, of the Rocky Flats movement. In addition, a program will be dedicated to the future of anti-nuclear activism, picking up on many of the issues activists have been working on over the past few years.
The real work of the anti-Rocky Flats movement is yet to be done.
This program was produced with support from the Need More Fund and KGNU. Thanks to Joy Boston and the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center for providing archival recordings. If you have a question or a comment about this program, call the KGNU comment line at 303-447-9911. Copies of this four-part radio documentary are available by contacting KGNU. Our number is 303-449-4885. Proceeds will benefit both KGNU and the Rocky Mountain Peace and Justice Center. For Return to the Nuclear Crossroads and KGNU, I'm David Wilson.